Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. If you enjoy this podcast, please give it a top rating and review on iTunes, and feel free to follow me on Twitter at Manuel Staggers. This episode is brought to you by Descartes Finance. Descartes is the leading Swiss digital wealth manager, providing its products and services to individuals, family offices, charitable organizations, banks, and asset managers. Its investment strategies lead the way. They harness the largest know-how as only a digital investment advisor can. To learn more, please visit www.descartes-finance.com. My guest today is Michael Sidler. Michael has co-founded Red Alpine Venture Partners in Zurich, Switzerland, where he invests mainly in tech and biotech companies, but is investigating how crypto and blockchain technologies change the VC industry. Michael has a PhD in life sciences from the University of Zurich, and he is active in organizations, juries, and boards for the support of innovation and startups in Switzerland. And now, to the interview. Hello, Michael, and thanks a lot for making time today.
Hi, Manuel.
Michael, you manage a VC fund out of Switzerland, focusing mainly on tech and biotech investments, but now you also started looking into crypto investments. What is your approach there from a VC perspective?
Right. So Red Alpine has been around since more than 10 years now, managing several funds. We're a classical VC investor, meaning we do equity investments. We hold them and then we exit them again. And now there is this new technology and new field popping up, cryptocurrencies, tokens, ICOs, blockchain, all around that. And of course, as a classical VC investing in tech, it is something where we have to have a focus, or at least to figure out, is this something that could be of interest to us? And therefore, we started to look at that with Red Alpine a while ago. We have dedicated resources just caring about crypto, the crypto space. So analyzing investment opportunities. So far, we cannot invest in tokens out of our funds directly. That would be a regulatory challenge. Nevertheless, I'm quite convinced that in the not too distant future, we will be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And then we also will be able to do larger investments. So far, we do investments out of a side pocket that we have to just get our feet wet in that space.
Mm-hmm. But privately, you've been investing for a while in this field.
Privately, I've been investing for quite a while. I've started to buy my first Bitcoins in 2013. I'm quite a happy investor in that respect. I was completely fascinated. I didn't understand it. I was completely fascinated, and I noticed that some very clever people around me started to look into that as well. The person who brought it to me in the first place was Lucius Meisser. And shortly thereafter, I saw somewhere a talk of Vitalik Buterin. I did probably not understand much of it, but being quite a liberal mind and an entrepreneur and also curious about new stuff, I was immediately hooked, and I tried to buy a couple of those coins, which was an adventure in itself. Mm-hmm.
So what was the fascination for you? I mean, was it the ideology of Bitcoin, of decentralization, or was it more the, you know, the investment aspect? What drew you to it?
So basically, yes, I'm motivated to generate a return on my investments. That's quite clear. However, here in the crypto space and in the blockchain space, to me, the whole decentralization idea and philosophy is incredibly fascinating. It's definitely a paradigm shift, and to be part of that is really a great adventure. So that's my first and foremost motivation, and to generate a return or to basically be part of the ride, that's a nice side effect, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Is it also something that investors come to you for and say, hey, why we look at the markets, we see all these gains, why are you not investing in these kinds of companies?
Plenty, yes. You know, among our limited partners, the investors in our funds, we have really a lot of investors who are equally interested or fascinated with the blockchain space or with cryptos, and yet they have no clue how to deal about that or what to do with it. And it would be probably not that difficult to raise a dedicated fund for that from our investors. However, I guess, having said so, before we would do something like that, we have to have a rock solid strategy, because raising money and not knowing what to do is not a good start.
You said before you have one analyst, I think, dedicated to the crypto space. How is the way that person looks at the crypto space different from maybe looking at other tech investments?
That's a great question. Much of it is quite the same, how we look at it. We look at it really from the perspective of a VC. And that's a bit different from the perspective that many typical crypto investors or ICO investors have. And I can elaborate to that. So there is that difference. And then there is, of course, the difference between what a VC typically does and how you analyze a crypto. The first one, and I think our experience from more than 15 years of investing into tech startups is really quite simple. The biggest proxy or the biggest indicator for future success of a company or of a concept or of a project is basically the quality of its founding team. And that 60 to 70% of the future success is being driven by that quality. And if we analyze a crypto investment opportunity, yes, of course, sometimes it's a decentralized concept that has a foundation at its background. Nevertheless, there is a core of people, a core team of people driving that. And here, I believe it's exactly the same. If you have a dedicated bunch of fantastic entrepreneurs, then the chances that this succeeds are much higher than if you have a sort of aggregated group of smart people who are not committed. So in the end, it's really important to understand who is driving it and who is the team behind it. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
What makes a good team in this field?
This is an excellent question. A good team is something you cannot figure out by going to a data room and looking at the CVs of these people. You have to work with them. You have to see them in action. You have to see them interact. You have to see how do they deal with their clients, competitors, customers, the regulator. So basically, you have to follow them for a certain while to feel the chemistry in the team and to understand if they're entrepreneurs or not. And that's basically what we say is the quality. And what we want to see whenever we analyze an investment opportunity is we want to see as a movie of how a team or a situation develops. Typically, you see a snapshot of a situation. So you see, for example, a white paper or a concept, and then you have to decide, do I want to invest or not? What we want to see, we want to be able to follow these people for a stretch of time. Sometimes that's 6 months, sometimes that's even 12 months, until we are comfortable to do an investment. And we would also want to do that, or we actually want to do that also when it is about crypto investments, because I don't see one single reason why that should be different in the crypto space than in the other tech space areas.
Well, the entrepreneur might say, I mean, one reason I can think of, you know, off the top of my head is this space is moving so fast, you have to get on board now, and otherwise we're you know, valued at $1 billion. And then you can't get in anymore.
Yes, that's true. And you're absolutely right there. And even more so, we have really a lot of deal flow. So we have 1,500 to 2,000 proposals that we analyze every year. So by no means we can follow all these teams in detail. In order to qualify the quality of a team, though, we usually or very often use our network. So we have a dense network of former entrepreneurs, of investors, and quite an international network who know how we think and what we are looking for. And if we receive pre-qualified deal flow from somebody who we trust and who has observed the team and also the idea for a while, then that is a proxy for us that we can use. And so therefore, if somebody in the Bitcoin or blockchain or crypto space comes up with an idea and has an investment suggestion, and we know how this person thinks and we trust their opinion, then of course for us that is a really good pre-qualification and a validation.
Mm-hmm. Are there, comparing again, the traditional, more, you know, conventional, let's say, tech space and the crypto space, are there any characteristics of the team that are markedly different that you need for the project to qualify for you?
Good question. Again, I don't know. I have not thought about that too much. I don't think so. Yes, maybe you have to, of course, it depends on the sector where we are. I mean, you have to have certain people with an in-depth knowledge about what they do. That's quite clear. Eventually, you have to have, I guess, the same kind of people with an inner fire burning for their specific cause. That's exactly what makes a good entrepreneur. And then you have to have some people who are able to take very important strategic decisions. And then you have to have people who are the natural leaders who can bond teams together and lead them to great success. And I guess there's not a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I'm sure there is much more in common than there is different, right?
Yes.
And I've also seen people tell me, you know, they said, well, it's hard to launch companies like these out of academia, for example, because these people may have, you know, a PhD or a group of PhDs, but they don't have the entrepreneurial experience, and then it gets very difficult.
It's not the case, I guess, statistically, that first-time entrepreneurs are less successful than serial entrepreneurs. If you look at some great examples in the tech world, like Facebook and the like, I think that's exactly what we try to do. Are these guys coming out of academia, do they have the entrepreneurial talent or do they not have it? And that's exactly the call we need to be able to make. I mean, it could be a bunch of nerds that will never be good entrepreneurs, or it could be a bunch of nerds as well, and some of them have entrepreneurial talent. And that's exactly what we want to figure out.
Mm-hmm. How do you gauge that from somebody who has, you know, zero track record as an entrepreneur? How do you see that they have this entrepreneurial gene?
Yeah, that goes back to what I said before. We need to be able to follow them. Mm-hmm. So if we see them, what they want to do, they have a plan, they have a roadmap and a couple of things on their roadmap. And then they tell us what they want to do. And then we see them a month or two later and they tell us what they have done, and we see that they basically have delivered, they have encountered a couple of challenges, they have managed to deal with those challenges, And then they tell us now our next steps is this and this and this. And then they come again back and tell us that they have achieved what they have planned. That starts to really become then a movie. That's what I was referring to before. And we see that they continuously achieve what they tell they want to do. And then we start to believe that the future plans are achievable as well. So that's what we want to see in a team. And especially it's interesting, it's of course interesting if they achieve their plans. It's very interesting or even more interesting if things do not go according to plan, to see how do they deal with that. This is really interesting for us to see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There is really a difference in the crypto space, of course, because there is a completely new paradigm, which is the ecosystem of a platform or of a blockchain or whatever you want to call that, which is going to be very important as well. You can have the smartest people with the smartest tokens and blockchains and concepts. If you don't have an ecosystem which is using it, it's not going to be worth much. So therefore, I guess that's going to be a quite an interesting, important point as well to analyze. And then, of course, the token mechanics aspect. This is something new for a VC. Typically, that's not a point in a typical equity investment. Mm-hmm.
What is your background, Michael? I mean, are you coming from the tech sector? I mean, you said you're an entrepreneur, but how do you go about, you know, understanding what are all these companies are about? I mean, do you have a background in engineering or software development?
Yeah, I'm a strange guy. I'm a molecular biologist. I did a PhD and then I left academia and I went to management consulting. I spent 5 years in management consulting during the dot-com bubble and burst. That got me hooked. Then I basically left consulting and I went to a startup company in the biotech space. And that's how I got into angel investing and then eventually VC investing. So I have a scientific education, which makes me capable to understand technical and theoretical concepts in a structured way. I have learned much of investing and also actually some technology and internet stuff during my time at BCG in the consulting of tech companies, especially also in the internet space. So I did fintech stuff before that term was even coined. And then, of course, in order to understand new technologies and concepts, the experience that we have here as VCs really helps a lot. I mean, we do analysis of cases and technologies on a daily basis, every day, several cases. So that gives you a lot of experience and helps you to become incredibly quick in understanding concepts and new ideas. Mm-hmm.
In the crypto space, right, coming from a VC perspective, are there specific themes that you're more interested in than others?
Yes. So as a classical VC, we believe that the blockchain is a fantastic technology to change a lot of the existing processes in the IT landscape. This is not really a very disruptive thing. It's just making existing processes better and cheaper. But the blockchain is definitely going to change that landscape. That's something we're interested in, and that mostly can be classical equity investments. Something that we believe is incredibly interesting for a VC is the tokenization of securities, for example. So if the shares of the companies that we are invested in can be tokenized. That would definitely, in certain cases, be really beneficial to enable a trading or transaction in a very easy way. This would be interesting to change basically the way equity investments are being done, but it's still going to be an equity investment. It's just an equity token instead of a title that you hold somewhere in an account.
But that means you would be buying tokens.
Either we would be buying tokens, but it's security tokens, which eventually is going to be still a share, or we would tokenize the shares of our portfolio companies such that we can start to trade them. And that will really change the way how venture capital is being done, because the current paradigm is you invest a couple of millions in a company, you hold that investment until there is an exit. And most likely the exit is either the divestment of the company to a strategic buyer, a so-called trade sale, or the going public of that company. Now, if you have a company that is already generating revenues, that has a lot of customers, that is growing, and that is large enough to have some publicity, there you could imagine that a trade of shares could start to happen. And for a VC, it could be an interesting situation if you could start to trade some of the shares that you're holding before the company really goes exit. Mm-hmm. And that is a new concept that will also enable or actually mean that VCs have to become traders to a certain extent. And that's definitely a new trick that the old dog has to learn.
It's good that you said it now, but I wanted to ask how, you know, the whole idea of tokenization actually disrupts your own business. And you answered much of that before. But has it happened to you that a company that you were looking at all of a sudden said, you know what, we actually don't need you. We're just going to go make our own token sale?
Yes, I'm quite certain that we have discussed with companies that have decided to go the ICO route and basically started to do this kind of a way to raise money. I'm quite sure this is a situation which is not going to be too sustainable. In the end, if you get money from investors, you eventually have to pay back a return or enable these investors to somehow get a return.
You mean selling the tokens on their own is not sustainable, you mean?
No, it could be, but the point is that most of these ICOs happen with concepts. And everybody who has built up a platform company in the conventional way with equity knows how really hard it is to build up a platform with demand and supply. It's really, really hard. And just having an idea to build a platform and getting 50 million from investors is an incredibly risky proposition, because they have not delivered any proof so far that any of what they plan is going to be is going to work, or that they're able to implement that. There's just nothing there. Mm-hmm. And so getting back to your question, if I think the current frenzy, the ICO frenzy, will sort of, the dust will settle and we will find a way how the ICO tool is going to be a worthwhile and valuable tool in the future, not even necessarily in the competition to VCs. I believe VCs will invest in ICOs, and I believe that
But that's happening already.
It's happening already. And I believe also that I think the really smart way for a company is to get some equity or some private money from somewhere, build an MVP or just something on a very low level to demonstrate that what they're actually planning can work, and then do the ICO instead of just having a white paper without anything in the back. Mm-hmm. And some teams, that's something you asked before, mentioned to us as well, we would like to get a VC in, but we are too early to get a VC in. That's at least what VCs tell us. Therefore, we cannot get a VC in and we need to do an IPO.
An ICO.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes, of course, at that point in time, I guess the VC is not competitive.
Maybe they spoke to the wrong VC.
No, yeah, I mean, maybe not. I mean, in the end, the fact that you can raise money through an ICO doesn't mean that in the future you don't have to pay a return. And that's going to be quite tough for many of those ICOs.
Mm-hmm. But if I understand right, the preferred way for you would be you become seed or early stage investor in a startup that has an idea for a token play of some sort. And then together with the startup, you and the startup do an ICO.
Yeah, for example, that could be an idea. I mean, in the end, again, it's not that different. If you want to raise money, you have to be able to show something. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to substantiate your plans. You have to have an MVP, you have to have some traction. And in order to do that, you need to get financed. You need to get money from somewhere. Either you have your own money from your family or from angel investors. And you can raise that in the form of equity, or you can raise it in the form of a private token sale. That works as well. But I guess the best ICOs, and we have already started to see that, are companies that have an existing business, and then they do an ICO, and that's really interesting then, like Telegram, for example.
Mm-hmm. And to build that existing business or that MVP, you can help them.
We can help them. That's definitely
our... I mean, that's your value proposition.
That's our value proposition. That's our job. That's what we do, exactly.
So, but how far does that change your daily work as a VC?
It doesn't. That's what we do. It's exactly the same. The beginning, the initial setup that we just discussed. The thing which is going to be disruptive for the VC is if, as I mentioned before, we can start to trade the shares of the companies we hold in our portfolio. Because then we can, as I mentioned before, do partial exits of positions that we have in our portfolio before the exit of the company happens.
But you can do that if the company ICOs.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. I mean, no, sorry. With the ICO, of course, yes. But also when you can securitize the securities or the equity.
So you basically tokenize your own VC fund.
Yeah, that could be an additional option. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely certain that this is going to be completely normal in a couple of years, that instead of having old-fashioned shares or units somewhere in a bank account with an ISIN number, you have a token. And you really have to understand the beauty of it when you look at how these shares usually are structured. So typically, when a VC invests, you have preferred shares with all kinds of rights. So you have rights of first refusal, you have liquidation preferences, you have anti-dilution provisions. You could bake all of that into a smart contract, which is basically connected to that token. And that would really make life of the companies and of the investors and the shareholders much, much easier. Because by having it in the form of a smart contract, you can guarantee that everything happens the way it's supposed to happen, because otherwise it just cannot get traded. So I think this is going to be a major impact on the life of VCs.
Mm-hmm. How open in general is the VC industry to that change?
I believe, as with any industry, you have the early adopters and you have the laggards and you have the mainstream guys, and you see the early adopters setting up crypto funds. You see that happen. You see the Draper family investing heavily in cryptos. You see also Andreessen Horowitz and many of them starting to invest. There are still different ways how VCs do this. A lot of experimentation happening. We're still in the very early days there. But as I said, the early adopters are already doing it. The laggards definitely don't. So therefore, that's going to just be adopted as an additional tool in the toolkit of a VC. And yes, some of the VCs may also miss that train, and then maybe they will go out of business or have to do something else.
Yeah, and yesterday I had an interesting chat with somebody who said tokenizing, let's say, investments that were previously reserved for high net worth individuals like private equity, venture capital, is a great thing because it gives people access to an asset class that they previously didn't have. How do you think about that aspect?
The reason why the VC business is not completely going to be dismantled and disrupted is because in the end, the most important factor for a successful company or a concept is the people. And to have a way to analyze those teams and to understand the business cases and how the people are able to deliver on their plans, that is a core ability of VCs. And therefore, it's not just going to go away. And you have to have this function in some way or shape in the system.
And in the ICO space, exactly that's missing, that vetting.
That's missing to a great extent. I mean, plenty of token investors are more coming from a hedge fund side, which is not bad, but not sufficient. Because, again, hedge fund investors typically analyze the underlying securities or assets. And the VC analyzes to a very large extent the potential of the team.
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. Descartes Finance takes tradition into the future, harnessing a combination of cutting-edge technology and personal advice in the service of your personal interests. Descartes cuts through the financial noise and focuses exclusively on scientific and evidence-based investing to give investors a better understanding of how to view the financial markets and provide them with their respective investment strategies. To learn more, please visit www.descartes-finance.com. That's descartes-finance.com.
I want to ask again about this argument with real assets on the blockchain. What kind of challenges do you see there in that regard?
The big challenge I see is that somewhere in the world, this asset has to be physically. And you have to have somebody who is guaranteeing you that the asset is still there, and that eventually it's not being sold several times. And to come back to the idea with the diamonds, that's quite simple because the diamonds are uniquely identifiable and you can hold them in a storage space which is audited, for example. You can do the same with art pieces. It starts to become a bit more difficult when you start to tokenize, I don't know, ships or cars or real estate. I mean, eventually you always have to have somebody, some auditor, who confirms that the fraction you hold is still there and that it's still the same fraction. And I think that's quite the challenge.
I mean, some people told me it's a deal breaker. It will not work because it's exactly what the original idea of the blockchain, you know, it was all about keeping everything digital. And now you introduce real assets. So then you introduce a whole bunch of things that will, you know, negate the whole concept.
I don't see why this is a deal breaker. I mean, the blockchain will enable a ton of business models and applications and use cases, which we don't see yet. There will be information being stored and made accessible through the blockchain. There will be these microtransactions between robots and basically the IoT idea. I'm pretty sure there will be assets that are getting tokenized. Some of the simpler assets, but then also, I guess, if you have a functioning legal framework, you can also tokenize real estate. Why not? As long as you have, the normal checks and balances that you have in the conventional world, where you can check if it's still in the Grundbuch and whatnot, then of course you can put it on the blockchain. I don't see a reason why not. It's getting more difficult if you start to buy maybe real estate in some African countries, because then again you have to trust somebody who tells you that you still own a piece of that. And if this is not really a well-trusted entity or institution, then it's going to become very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen applications of this tokenization of real assets that work?
I could not pretend that I have seen a platform which is sustainably trading tokenized assets yet. But there are plenty of concepts there.
And the application of the idea of, let's say, tokenizing diamonds, has that happened?
Yes, as far as I understand, to a certain extent, yes.
So that's a proof of concept then almost. So it's now it's about scaling that to other...
Yes and no. There's a proof of concept of the technology behind it and maybe even of the logistics. Like, again, going back to the diamond, getting the diamond into the safe. You have to get it from somewhere, put it into the safe, and then basically make sure that it's there and then issue the token and then sell the token. I mean, this has been proven. But the big proof comes when that platform has enough demand and supply such that it runs on its own. I mean, this I believe is the big thing that many of the ICOs just don't factor in when they go and do their ICO. Every platform has to have participants. And in the conventional world, the founders know that these participants and users come at a certain cost. So sometimes $50, sometimes $100, sometimes $300, you have user acquisition costs. So if you have a white paper that shows I want to have 10 million users, then you better make sure that you know how you come up with the maybe 100 million that you need in order to acquire those users. So sometimes that's just getting forgotten, that you have to have a massive marketing effort to basically get these users. And it's not just one side of the platform. You have some. You have to have some users who are basically building the demand side, and some users who are building the supply side. Always, if some transaction happens. And most of the white papers just don't know how they're going to do that. Even if you have data on your platform, who acquires the data providers? They just usually don't know, if you ask that.
What do you mean, who acquires the data providers?
There are companies. I mean, for example, you are a platform that hosts and exchanges health data. Maybe not the very confidential stuff, but more like the step counter, the Fitbit, I don't know, that stuff. So you have a lot of companies that are interested in this kind of information, because if you can connect your data that you track from your cell phones or your trackers together with your information about your person, your age, your gender, your fitness level, what you eat, and so on. And if you can offer that in an aggregated form to, for example, pharma companies, they would be really, really interested in that, and they would also pay money for that. And there are a couple of platforms offering that through the blockchain, because they say the blockchain is the only way how you enable the user to control his own data, which is entirely true. But then what you have to do is you have to start to acquire the customers, the pharma companies, who will pay for this information. And you have to acquire the people who deliver their information onto the platform. And usually they just think about how to build the platform, but they don't think about how to get the users and the customers onto that platform.
And that comes at a cost.
That comes at a tremendous cost. And sometimes it's much more difficult than you think. As the typical startup entrepreneur knows, there is this the lean startup concept, where you have to start with something, try it out, change it, amend it, measure it again, change it again. So really constant trial and error approach, sometimes over months and months, until you find the sweet spot. And that kind of that's the, coming back to what you asked before, this is to me the real proof of the concept. If they have managed to get sufficient demand and supply on their blockchain platform for their specific use cases.
So in a lab environment it works, but what if you go into the wild?
Yes, I mean, you can build the smartest tools, but if nobody uses it, it's in vain. You have to. It's the biggest challenge usually is to change the behavior of the people. It's not to build it technically. It's you have to have these people to love it, to use it, and to basically also talk about it, because then it goes viral. And if you don't manage to change the behavior of your users on either side, then you're just doomed.
So basically it comes back to the main challenges in changing the world are not technology, but how to change the behavior of people.
I mean, of course, yes, you have to be able to build it. If you're not able to build it, and also at the, not only to build it, but also to build it at the reasonable cost. If you're not able to do that, then of course you're lost anyhow. But once you've built it, then you have to make people love it. And then it's user interaction, user experience, user satisfaction. And that's really extremely old school. I mean, what people love does not change just because there is a blockchain.
There is an idea and then, you know, a white paper and maybe a capable team even who can build something. And then there's a vision of what the world will look like when everybody uses it. But how do we get there?
Exactly. And also, there has to be a sufficient incentive for people to do it. If somebody has to be really convincing and giving me a lot of money such that I would start to share my Fitbit data with a blockchain platform, I mean, it would be just too big of a hassle in the beginning. But when they make it extremely easy and maybe even trendy, such that people start to talk about it, and I see, oh, I can really make some money by doing that, then it could sort of catch some fire. But that again is something you cannot just write down in a white paper. It's something you have to try and adapt and basically custom engineer to the specific situation.
Mm-hmm. What's the lesson there for entrepreneurs, you know, in the blockchain and crypto space, that they should, you know, focus much more on user experience, onboarding cost, you know, you said user acquisition, right? I mean, is that the main lesson, or what else should they do better?
To me, yes, of course. I mean, in the end, two things that I, when I read a white paper, I ask these guys, so in order to have a meaningful number of transactions on your platform, how many people do you need to acquire? So going back to the diamond example, how many diamond traders or diamond sellers do you have to get onto your platform such that you can do a, maybe a transaction of 1,000 diamonds on your platform? So you have one trader, one supplier who is supplying one diamond, or you have one who is supplying 100 diamonds, or, and where will they be located, these guys? And how are you going to win them over such that they trust your platform? And then on the other side, you have to find the guys, the people who are willing to basically invest their money to buy the tokens, the tokenized diamonds. It's a huge marketing effort. It's huge. Yes, the benefits for the diamond seller are maybe that the price is much more transparent. He much maybe gets a much higher price than if he sells to his usual trading partners. But there you have to really understand what is the benefit for every part in the whole ecosystem. Because if you have parts in your ecosystem that don't have a sufficiently large benefit, it's just not going to work. So I would like really like to see a quantified rationale behind everything. And then on the other hand, the second question that I ask, why are you issuing 10 billion tokens? Why not 9.5 billion? Why not 6.5 billion? Why not 1 billion? Why 10? Usually they don't know. They just know 10 billion is a nice number, and they know that the other platforms do the same. But basically, what I would like to see is that somebody has been sitting down and thinking about it, like you calculate the amount of money in a monetary system, for example. It's really not easy. And I would like to see that justified. Why exactly 10 billion tokens? And how is that going to work if you have 1,000 diamonds that are getting traded every year? Maybe it's 10,000 diamonds, maybe it's only 500, but just your tokens in connection with the diamonds, for example. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to be the diamonds, it could be something completely different. But that, I think, is something that in most white papers is missing as well.
Mm-hmm. In most white papers, you said, I mean, in how many of the companies that you look at, how many have like serious flaws, like the ones that you just mentioned, how many percent?
I'm not even sure if it's a flaw or not. It's just not there. And then...
Well, it's just something that disqualifies them, right?
Yes, then I think the typical thing, what you do is you... say to these guys, look, it's a very interesting concept. I would like to understand more. Can you sit down with me and explain it to me in detail? And then maybe you figure out these guys have sorted it out all. It's just not properly explained in the white paper. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you figure out they have not. And then, of course, this is really a red flag. That's the first test again if the team is an entrepreneurial and high quality team or not, the way they react to these kind of questions.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Recently, I had an interesting chat with somebody who does marketing for companies in the blockchain and token space. And he said they can just pay for people to use the platform. That's one thing many of the companies do. They issue tokens for usage of the platform. And then some people will always use it. And so, you know, instead of going down and marketing cleverly, you just pay people to use the platform. I mean, how sustainable is that?
That sounds to me like the perpetuum mobile. That sounds great. If you can pay people to use the platform such that the platform...
Pay them in tokens.
Pay them in tokens such that the platform is getting used and becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Maybe that works. I'm not even sure. Sounds cool, but eventually there's got to be a reason why you do on that platform something, either because you can make money or because you can get fun or because you can get some satisfaction in some way. Mm-hmm. So it boils down to the benefit. If you can make money by trading tokens and you can keep doing that, it's fantastic. I just think that it's probably not going to work. But it's something that we would have to discuss in more detail, I guess. Interesting concept, at least.
You need to provide a value to the user.
Look,
beyond just paying them.
I'm old enough to have experienced the dot-com bubble. And in the dot-com bubble, sometimes, I mean, when I look back to what we told people in that time, it's completely delusional from today's perspective. At that time, when you were in the bubble at that time, you really believed that. And to a certain extent, you have some similar tendencies today that people just start to tell stuff which they have heard from other people without really questioning it. Or without just believing it. And I still believe the fundamental mechanics of behavior and economics have not changed just because there is something which is called the blockchain. And in the end, I mean, whatever you do, it has still to interact and work with human people, human desires and ideas and needs, and that's not going to change. Mm-hmm.
Do you think more people are overestimating what the blockchain can do than underestimating it?
In the short run, it's completely, in certain areas, overhyped. In the long run, it's completely underestimated what's going to happen, or the changes that are going to be brought about by this technology.
What do you see, or what is on the horizon, you think, in the next 6 months, maybe to 2 to 3 years in this space?
Something that I'm eagerly awaiting is decentralized exchanges. Having Binance and Coinbase and the likes, who are actually centralized institutions and taking the lion's share of all of those trades and exchanges. I think it's needed, but the concept of a decentralized exchange is tremendously interesting, and it's going to be a game changer because it will make trades possible at lower costs, which is sometimes really required, especially for micropayments and stuff. And therefore, I think this is going to be quite an interesting concept, which is hopefully coming along in the next 6 to 12 months.
Mm-hmm. And beyond that?
Oh, beyond that, anything can happen. As I said, as an investor and VC, what I think should happen and what I hope it's going to happen sooner than later is a proper regulation of the space, such that we can move on and we know what we can do and what we cannot do. I guess especially in the asset-backed tokens and security-backed tokens, that's going to change how we do business. But right now, it's quite difficult to deal with it because of the regulatory aspects, which are not clear. And I hope Switzerland is really not missing that boat, because it's a fantastic opportunity for Switzerland to grasp and to basically be one of the global centers to really shape that space.
Well, it's been very interesting, and also I really appreciate your sharing, you know, how you work, how you approach this asset class. I think it's very exciting and insightful also to, you know, to listen to this from the perspective as an investor or also from that as an entrepreneur. So thanks a lot for taking time today.
Thank you, Manuel. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.